Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be talking through all the week's news in just a moment with our special guest co-hosts, Joe Slowick and Tom Uren. Adam had something come up, so he couldn't make it this week, but the show will go on and he'll be back in the news seat next week. This week's show is brought to you by Google Cloud, and Anton Chuvakin, the head of security solution strategy at Google Cloud, will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about why SIEM vendors, including them, are gobbling up SOAR platforms in acquisitions. That is coming up later, but let's get into this week's news discussion now with Joe Slowick, a senior manager of threat intelligence and detection engineering at Gigamon. Welcome to you.
Happy to be here as always.
And also with us is Tom Uren, the writer behind our very own newsletter, Seriously Risky Business, which if you haven't already, you should absolutely subscribe to. Welcome to the show for the first time, Tom Uren.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. Good to be here. And absolutely, if you're listening to this, you should absolutely subscribe to this. No doubt in my mind.
That's the sort of get up and go we love here at Risky Business Media Enterprises. Well done. All right. So, we got a great run sheet this week. We got a bunch of good stories to talk about. The first one we want to dive into, though, is there's been a lot of headlines generated about Citizen Lab's analysis of the app that athletes and various attendees at the Beijing Olympics need to use while attending the event. Citizen Lab wrote a somewhat lurid analysis claiming that it contained quote-unquote devastating encryption flaws and whatnot. But to me, this whole thing just rang a little bit funny. Tom, I know you're working on this one for this week's newsletter. What was your immediate feeling when we started seeing all of the headlines saying that this, you know, sort of implying that this whole thing was some, you know, Chinese government plot to steal people's whatevers?
I just thought that if you're in Beijing for the Olympics, having an app that's not particularly secure is the least of your worries. For some people, that's actually what I would call a hostile environment. The report read to me like just as bad as any other app.
It's a government-developed app is what I took away from it. Oh, they mishandled, you know, encryption and whatever. It's like, well, yeah, it's a government app.
Yeah, that's right. So the real problem is that apps are generally poor. The Chinese government actually has legitimate reasons to ask for a lot of personal data in this case, given that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And you're giving the data to the Chinese government in the first place. So encryption is probably the least of the problems. It was encrypted. It was just not perfect.
Yeah, I don't think they were correctly verifying that stuff was going to the right server. So if you could get, you could get a person in the middle on it, you might be able to capture the data that was already going to the Chinese government in the first place. You know, Joe, we've also seen some what I think is pretty sensible advice, which is, you know, if you're concerned about this sort of thing, take a burner phone with you and, leave your main iPhone at home, right?
Yes, and this might be one of those cases where that typical DEFCON advice actually rings true, that in this case, if you really are worried about this, if your personal threat model encompasses this sort of activity, then buying a cheap Android device for using for a couple of weeks or whatever might not be a terrible idea.
So look, I guess one thing I want to ask here is, like, it does feel like, you know, Citizen Lab used to be, and for the most part still is, an organization where people could take their research reports, you know, write about them and whatever, and you didn't really have to do much interpretation. You didn't need to get some expert to interpret what Citizen Lab was saying, because they were this very sort of trusted, moderate voice in this world, right? And do you think that they've maybe damaged their reputation a little bit by coming out so hard against this, Joe?
You know, everyone's allowed to flub one once in a while. The amount or the degree of hype or concern around what seems like it was more of a cock-up as opposed to something that was malicious does seem a little strange. But, you know, if this becomes a trend, then I say it's something that we need to keep an eye on. But if this is a one-off just in line with a headline event, I'm less concerned, at least in isolation.
Yeah. So we've linked through to a pretty decent write-up from The Guardian in this week's show notes, combined with a link to the report from Citizen Lab itself. Now I want to turn our attention. Look, Kim Zetta over on her Substack has been doing an absolutely terrific job writing about some of these developments in Ukraine, in particular, you know, the wiper attacks against the Ukraine government. She's got a great piece up here, which looks at the code similarities between some ransomware called White Black Crypt and the code targeting the Ukraine government, which has been dubbed Whispergate. Now, what makes this interesting is this ransomware was used apparently to target Russian individuals and organizations, and now this thing is being used against the Ukraine government. Kim writes or sort of suggest in a coverage that this could be an attempt to have observers misattribute this activity to actors in Ukraine. But my feeling is, Joe, and I wonder what you think of this, is that this is more of an FU than an attempt at getting people to misattribute it. What do you think?
I mean, looking back at the history of events taking place and impacting Ukraine since 2014, 2015, we're dealing with, you know, likely adversaries that have exhibited a bit of trolling behavior over time, whether it's turning off the UPSs in the control stations in the 2015 power event, or just the sheer assholery that was NotPetya and whatnot, that this just seems kind of in line with that sort of activity. It's also worth pointing out that while the Ukrainian sources were pointing at a fairly firm link between these two, that Kim also reported that analysts at Microsoft, while acknowledging some overlap, said that it wasn't quite as cut and dry a case. So, you know, certainly something going on there, but, you know, to put this into some three-dimensional chess game of misattribution might be a bridge too far in this case.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there are some similarities there, you know, in my mind, it's Russians taking some malware that was used to target them by actors operating in Ukraine and saying, okay, well, we're just going to throw it back at you. Enjoy. Yeah. I guess maybe in the fullness of time, we will understand what exactly happened there. But, you know, it's always fun to speculate. We got a story here from The Record written by Catalin Kimpanu talking about APT-27 activity targeting German organizations. Now, this is a Chinese APT. Tom, this one caught your eye. Why don't you tell us why?
Mostly because there's been a sort of divergence in the last half dozen years or more between the US response to economic espionage and the European response. So the US has always had intellectual property that for many years the Chinese have been stealing, and they've responded quite vigorously with indictments and sanctions, and more recently a trade war that was at least partly to do with economic espionage. And the German government has warned about cyber espionage. And Germany certainly has a lot of industries that are high-tech, advanced manufacturing. They're Mittelstand, they're middle-sized companies. And those companies are probably not quite big enough to be able to defend themselves really well. And yet all the German government has done is warn about it. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering, will there be a change in approach? And I guess looking at Huawei, the US was relatively robust early, and eventually Europe followed along in a more measured way, perhaps. So I'm just wondering if that's what's going to happen.
So you're wondering if some momentum could build here, and perhaps European countries might actually start to get a bit more aggressive in their response. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
So to be clear, from what you were saying, it sounds like APT-27 are doing that sort of IP theft that Chinese APTs are very well known for.
Yeah, they've been doing it in Germany. I know people there have been worried about it for a long time, but they've not done anything that I see that's really substantive about it yet.
Yeah, okay. Joe, I mean, just, you know, we're sort of talking about the American response to Chinese APTs and, you know, how it's been much more aggressive. Has it actually made an impact, would you say? Because I know you're pretty plugged into that threat intel community. Has there been much of a change in terms of, you know, Chinese targeting behavior and IP theft in the United States? Or is that just not something that's particularly easy to get your hands around?
I don't think anyone can give a definitive answer on the subject, but at least just from what information's available and what's been publicly disclosed, such as the Hafnium event targeting the proxy shell vulnerability, which oddly enough was also included in the APT-27 activity, but several months after that took place, that maybe we've seen a difference in degree, but certainly nothing has gone away. And it's just too valuable, too useful, too effective as a mechanism for it to completely disappear at this point, I would say.
I mean, my controversial opinion back in the day when all of this IP theft stuff first surfaced, right, as an issue was China is not a poor country anymore, right? I think its GDP per capita is roughly equivalent to that of Brazil. So it's certainly not a rich country, but I would not describe it as a poor country anymore. And, you know, a lot of this IP theft probably helped lift quite a few people out of poverty, right? So if you're the Chinese government, it's hard to see why you shouldn't do this. I guess that might change, though, as it becomes a country that wants to be taken more seriously as one that doesn't do that sort of thing. What do you think of that, Tom? Do you think that eventually the motivations to keep doing this for China just won't line up anymore?
Look, I think to some extent. I also think that looking at it as a purely economic thing is a bit narrow. So to me, the reason the Chinese government does this is because they're worried about internal stability. And so developing industries, good domestic industries, is actually an existential driver. And so the
less about helping the poor and more about maintaining your grip on power by keeping industry humming.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you if that is correct, it makes it very hard to see what you can actually do to stop that. It's not because they want to be rich, it's because they want to stay in power. But I still think it's worth doing more than many governments are doing right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving on. And Microsoft has recorded a new high watermark in the world of DDoS attacks. They clocked one that was 3.47 terabits per second. Joe, that's a lot of packets.
That is an awful lot of packets. And it highlights that as stupid simple of an attack or annoyance that denial of service and distributed denial of service are, it's still a pretty serious threat. Certainly it's one that you throw enough money at the problem and you can make it go away, but not everyone can do that. And as we've seen from anything like this instance to the weird incident with Endora getting knocked off the internet because of a Minecraft tournament and some people DOSing servers before the lulls, that this is a serious problem. Then as we get more and more endpoints that are out there that can be compromised and brought into these botnets through things like Mirai and other features, that it's just not something that's going to go away, even if its level of technical sophistication isn't something that's going to typically attract headlines.
The thing that makes me not so concerned about DDoS stuff, though, is that the monetization on the attacker's side, it just doesn't seem to be there. You'll see someone using like multi-terabit attacks, using some Mirai monster to go after some company, and then they're asking for like a $500, a $500 fee to make it stop. Now, I've said stuff like this where, and you know, we've also moved to a much more sort of CDN connected world, which mitigates a lot of this stuff. So I've always been pretty blasé about the true extent of the DDoS threat, which actually gets me angry DMs from people who are saying, no, this is a very big deal. Where do you fall on that spectrum between me being all sort of blasé about it and then thinking, no, this is gonna ruin us all?
Oh, solidly in the wishy-washy middle, of course, because that's what I would do in this case. But I mean, I wouldn't want, you know, this certainly isn't an existential crisis for the internet that critical services are going to go down, and that hasn't been the case probably ever in the case of denial of service events. But it's also not something, especially when we start talking about smaller organizations that lack the resources to pay for counter DDoS or DDoS mitigation services, that it can become a significant problem for them. But this isn't going to lead to the zombie apocalypse or anything similar anytime soon in the same breath.
Now, Tom, before you came to work with us, you worked for ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is a think tank here in Australia. And, you know, you've had a lot of contact with policy types. How far at the top of their mind is the issue of DDoS attacks?
I don't think anyone ever mentioned it to me. So there was that attack on the New Zealand Stock Exchange a little while ago, and that got some headlines. I guess the question to me is that you've kind of got a few centralized providers, and are the centralized providers getting bigger and better faster than those distributed attacks are getting worse?
Yeah, so it's about just looking at those trend lines. Okay, so the long-anticipated White House memo instructing US government departments to embrace a zero-trust strategy and come up with a plan in X number of days and roll it out within X number of years, that one has landed. Confusingly, there have been two memos. There's been one targeted at national security systems and now one just targeted at the broader US government. Joe, of course, you are located in the United States. I'd imagine that this is just such a monumental security uplift that this is all people in FedGov are going to be doing for the next couple of years, or am I being a bit dramatic?
Well, it all depends. So certainly what's been put forth is very ambitious, and if there is follow through and sufficient resourcing to back it up, it will be quite significant in dramatically changing the security posture of, you know, a significant portion of the public sector in the United States. Having said that, between things like allocating budget in order to make these things happen, changes in administration and leadership, should that happen over the next couple of years here, that, you know, just as we've seen with things like migration to cloud and other big technical initiatives, you know, how lasting is this going to will this be is an open question. Having said that, I think it is a move in the right direction. We're just now in a waiting position to see how it'll actually be implemented and followed through.
I can't see the Republicans spiking this one if they do take power again, because it just strikes me as the sort of thing that is so politically nowhere that I just can't imagine Trump even this even hitting his radar. No, we can't do this zero trust thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, you look at some of the executive orders that came out during Trump's time, and I think, you know, Rob Joyce might have been behind some of them. And I just get the impression Trump really didn't care what the nerds were up to, you know?
Yeah, and that's very fair. Again, given the state of things in the United States right now, I'm not taking anything off the table, to be very honest. But, you know, again, a lot of this is a combination, not just of the order itself, but what sort of meat and heft is put behind it in order to actually follow through with it, which, again, I'm really hoping that this works out, but it'll really be determined at individual agency budgetary and allocation levels, and then ensuring that Congress and other entities are providing the allocations to meet those that refresh of federal IT networks in order to meet this new standard.
From a policy perspective, Tom, this seems actually quite ambitious, almost surprisingly ambitious. I guess the risk here, though, is that it sort of derails and the projects all blow out in budget and time, and it just turns into a bit of a mess. What's your feeling for how this might play out?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's really the budget that I think affects whether it's successful or not. And I think the first step, if I recall correctly, was to come up with a budget for the next 2 years. And I think at that point, that's when people really think about, okay, is this something we really want? How much did you say?
Yeah. Then there's the capacity constraint you might actually hit when you try to roll it out, when every single government department's trying to do the same thing at the same time. Like, how many specialists do you have to do this one building block of this strategy, you know?
Yeah. So I think it's great to have grand plans without attaching them to actual costs, because costs means you're not doing something else. And, you know, you have to make that choice at some point.
Now, we've got the White House also expanding regulations for the U.S. Water supply, cyber regulations. Joe, what did you think of this? Because, you know, you used to work for Dragos. You've got a lot of ICS security experience. Do you think these sort of regulations are kind of long overdue? Because, I mean, yes. This story written by Kevin Collier makes a good point, which is this isn't centrally controlled infrastructure. It's run by so many different organizations. There's 50,000 water and wastewater facilities across the United States, all run by sort of different organizations. So maybe having some sort of baseline makes sense.
Yes, I mean, certainly having a baseline makes perfect sense, and the water sector is completely overlooked in light of things like the electric sector, oil and gas, and even manufacturing when it comes to critical infrastructure and the potential impacts that a malicious cyber event could have on water and wastewater infrastructure. But like you said, the problem is that this isn't something where you have a dozen or so huge utilities that make up a significant percentage of the market share, but you have anything ranging from the local cooperative that runs the water treatment for a town of 5 or 10,000 people to massive entities like the Chicago Wastewater and Sanitary District, which is one of the largest in the world, and many, many things in between. So given the diffusion in authorities, in legal regimes, etc., the best that we can really do at this point within the context of the United States is provide guidelines. And after that, it really becomes a question of how do we start either enforcing these or also making the resources available to a lot of these entities to make the investments necessary in order to meet what standards are being put out there finally.
Because we did see that that botched attack against a water treatment facility in Florida, which I think that's why we're starting to see this type of thing coming out in the United States. Even though that one had a happy ending, you can't guarantee it'll play out that way the next time, right?
Exactly. And we've seen a number of entities globally, especially some things in the Middle East involving Israel and potentially linked to a number of actors never really conclusively proven in public.
It was Iran. Come on, we can say it. It was probably Iran,
might
right?
As well. Yeah. But people are poking at this because they realize that it's a fairly soft target that has potentially significant implications for follow-on just health and safety reasons. And waking up to that risk is pretty important.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do war crimes over the internet, it's a pretty good place, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. The most interesting bit of ransomware news this week comes to us courtesy of AJ Vicens at CyberScoop, and he spotted, and this was a great catch, AJ, by the way, he spotted a interview with Dmitry Medvedev, the former Prime Minister and President of Russia, who now serves as the Russian Security Council Deputy Chairman. And in this interview, it's a broad-ranging interview, but there's a very short section on Russian cooperation with US authorities when it comes to ransomware. And Medvedev was making all of the right sounds, which, I got to be honest, actually kind of surprised me. What did you make of it, Tom?
I think the US and Russia, and even more so, maybe a lot more so, but certainly the Soviet Union, have a history of cooperation, even on very difficult areas, because it is in their interest. So I think that there's possibly a space where they do cooperate on cybercrime and ransomware. And I guess what we have to figure out is where that space is and how to get that space to work. So in the past, they've cooperated on the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation. You know, they cooperate on arms reduction and they do all sorts of confidence building measures. And these are difficult discussions, but they both recognize they're in their interest. So possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this is so much of the rhetoric around this is about how it's ransomware diplomacy, and this is all part of some geopolitical game, and Putin rounded up Reval because, you know, it was to show. I mean, the Washington Post wrote an editorial saying this was just to show the United States that they have the ability to combat this, and if you don't let us do what we want in Ukraine, we'll let them back out on the streets with all their criminal buddies to wreak havoc. And I just sort of wonder if the true story here is a bit more mundane, right? Which is that both sides recognize that this is a deeply irritating type of crime and they want to get on top of it. Is that at all possible, do you think?
I think both those things are possible. So they could be both using ransomware diplomacy and also wanting to cooperate. I guess it's only time will tell.
Yeah. What did you make of all of this, Joe?
I think a lot of what's already been said makes sense to me, that there are powerful reasons for Russian authorities, out of their own interest, to crack down on these groups, because it is not just a problem for the United States, for Germany, etc., but these are criminal elements that are involved in a multitude of other activities, including the money laundering and other aspects that go into making these sorts of schemes function. And it's a harmful thing for the Russian state. So there's certainly an element of self-interest to this, and we shouldn't overlook, despite other very serious tensions, we can't ignore those by any stretch of the imagination, but that substantial areas of agreement and cooperation exist on problems that are mutually impactful to the US, Russia, and others.
Where I agree with you, Tom, when you say that it's both, is that I think the root of this cooperation probably is a little bit boring, but you're right in that if things really kick off in Ukraine, all bets are off and this cooperation will probably disappear. That's my feeling. I just want to quote from the interview with Medvedev here, where he's talking about cooperation. So he says here, "In the field of cybersecurity, cooperation has now become much more active. This is perhaps one of the few areas where, despite very problematic relations with the United States, our cooperation has intensified, and it bears fruit, because it is in the interests of all. In this case, we agree with the position of the Americans that cybercrime must be fought collectively because it is transnational in nature. It doesn't matter which citizens participate, where they are, and so on, because we understand how it all works. Therefore, this is a positive example, what you call REVIL. There are some other examples. Such cooperation has been established, including through the staffs of the security councils, and I hope it will develop. The main thing, so that our partners understand the value of this cooperation and reciprocate." I think they mean the main thing is, should be, that our partners understand the value of this cooperation and reciprocate. And they understood in this case it was possible to do much harm to each other, but there would be no benefit from this as a whole. And then he goes on to talk about how they're kind of waiting on the United States to help them chase down a DDoS attack that targeted some local elections in Russia. So anyway, that just kind of left me, I know I'll be accused of being extremely naive, but it left me a little bit hopeful that we might see some progress here. And yeah, you only have to look at this next piece we're going to talk about to realize why Russia might actually have, a vested interest in making this problem go away. There's been an attack against a German fuel storage provider. And of course, Russia sends a lot of energy to Germany. So I can't imagine they'd appreciate this particular supply chain being disrupted.
Yes. So Germany imports most of its oil from Russian sources. So there's certainly an element of own goal if these are Russian-based entities that are responsible for this ransomware event. It is worth noting, and it has been reported, that this was an IT system impact. So echoes of Colonial Pipeline here, where impacts at the IT level result in inability to operate some other things at the physical process level without actually targeting or impacting physical processes directly. But it still seems like this has been quite disruptive and has resulted in some changes in operations by organizations like Royal Dutch Shell, among others, in trying to overcome some of the disruption that this has caused to fuel distribution within Germany.
And look, we are sticking with the ransomware theme. It looks like an Iranian state-sponsored group, APT-35, has now been linked to a ransomware strain called Memento. And we are seeing more of this sort of either state-directed activity or moonlighting. And this is one of the things that I've you know, pretty consistently said I expected to see more of this, which is why I was skeptical that just improved diplomatic relations with Russia would actually fix this, and that we would maybe need to take the release the hounds doctrine seriously. Tom, what did you make of this one?
Yeah, I 100% agree. I've heard of various APT-linked groups moonlighting. And I guess at this point, they're kind of looking at how successful ransomware is and saying, instead of just trying to steal things and sell them, why don't we ransomware in our spare time? So the article talks about how if there was an Iranian government interest, they would just conduct an espionage, but if there wasn't, they would deploy ransomware. So I expect that will become more common. And I suppose in the context of applying diplomatic pressure, the problem is that some other geopolitical issues just trump how much you care about ransomware. So when it comes to nuclear proliferation,
hard to put this on the agenda when you're negotiating some sort of treaty with Iran, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So same with the North Koreans. Like, how do you get them to stop this when they're already so isolated, right? Like, what can you do?
And you'd probably prefer them to stop lobbing ICBMs rather than worry about ransomware. It's just priorities.
Do you reckon we're going to see more of this, Joe?
I definitely think so, and we've been seeing this for a few years. It's interesting looking at APT-35, also referred to as Charming Kitten, depending upon who you're reading, or Phosphorus, I think, is another name for this, that within the threat intelligence community, this entity is seen as contractors. So not directly Iranian state, but some entity that's hired by the Iranian state to go do operations. And we've seen this sort of relationship with contracted entities that serve state-sponsored interests also branching out into more monetized schemes like ransomware.
Well, it's like some of the Chinese crews going around knocking off online casinos and stuff, right?
Exactly. Or even an event from a couple of years ago that I thought was overlooked of a Winty linked, which Winty is so problematic, let's not even get into that now.
We wrote a whole story about that, but anyway.
Yeah, but a group linked to those operations that was responsible for a fairly large-scale ransomware event in Taiwan that the Taiwan authorities then linked back to the Chinese state affiliated entity. So this is certainly something that I think, as we see a diffusion of capabilities and more of these sort of hack for hire entities that normally work with state operators look to pad their wallet, so to speak, that this is not going away anytime soon. And if anything else, is probably going to just continue on a steady increase.
Well, there is a silver lining here, and it was one that I was discussing with Tom before we started recording, which is, you know, one of the dilemmas for the agencies like Cyber Command in going after these guys is that they are essentially targeting civilians who have no nexus with a state. Whereas when you're dealing with state-directed or controlled activity, even if it's not state-directed, right, even if they are contractors, if it's the same people who are essentially agents of the state, it makes the authorizations you'd need to target them, you know, the paperwork's going to be easier. Let's just put it that way. I mean, that's kind of the gist of it, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, I think if I was in Cyber Command or wherever writing that kind of authorization paperwork, I'd just pick out the bits that highlight the link to the state and perhaps just downplay or edit out the bits that make it look like it's moonlighting. Now, having said that, I think the actual best approach in terms of offensive action is to just figure out which groups are most damaging and ignore the state links, because it's really super common that on the internet that you see a few groups responsible for a huge amount of the problems.
But they're the problematic ones because they tend to be the actual criminals, right, with no links to a state. What I'm getting at with these is they could become the, you know, you could test a lot of strategies against these ones because you're going to have no problem authorizing it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just wouldn't want them to always focus on the ones that are state-linked if they're not the most problematic ones.
No, but maybe they can prove it, right? Like, maybe they can prove that this sort of action works. Anyway, we live in hope. What else do we have here? I think we're getting into some smaller stories now in the run sheet. A whole bunch of QNAP NAS devices have been locked up by some ransomware called Deadbolt. Apparently, QNAP was, like, sending out emergency patches and whatnot, but I think the attackers are demanding 0.03 Bitcoin to receive a decryption key, but their decryptor's really bad. So MZSoft has released like their own decryptor where you take the key and plug it into their decryptor and that works better. They've also demanded 5 Bitcoin to shake down QNAP itself for details of the vulnerability and 50 Bitcoin if they want a universal decryptor. So it's an interesting monetization strategy for this type of ransomware. And it's very similar to what we saw in the Kaseya attack. Again, I think this could become a trend. What did you think, Joe?
I think you're right that as we've seen this sort of competitive market in the ransomware ecosystem between defenders and crackdowns and whatnot, and then trying to continue to monetize this industry or this threat vector, that organizations are going to look for alternative revenue streams or alternative ways of raising funds, whether that's, you know, basically bug hunting or whatever illicitly and then holding those vulnerabilities hostage like we're seeing here, or the sort of double and triple extortion operations that started to become popular last year, that there's just continual innovation in this space because the money's there and it's worth doing.
Yeah. Well, I expect we'll see more of this sort of thing, and I guess we'll have to wait and see if QNAP actually winds up paying, because you could see how they would, right? That's the thing. When you look at this, when you saw it in the Kaseya situation, ransoming the vendor just seemed like pretty inspired, I got to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly translates things into another level where you have an organization that's not just worried about their operations, but worried about their reputation and their ability to continue to do business and have the confidence of their own consumer base moving forward. So it really sets up a very powerful set of incentives for these organizations to try to cooperate in order to make that pain go away.
Just going to mention the next couple there in the show notes, but Chainalysis did a report saying that cyber criminals laundered $8.6 billion worth of cryptocurrency in 2021. So you can check out Catalan's write-up over at The Record on that one. The admin of Deep.Web, this was like a website that would link people through, provide links to Tor Onion sites where there were dark web marketplaces, and even do like reviews and rankings and stuff. We reported the arrest of this guy at the time. He's now been sentenced to 8 years in prison because he was taking kickbacks from the dark web operators to like feature their sites and stuff. So yeah, can't do that. That's illegal, as he has now discovered. But the next one I wanted to talk about is this one from Ars Technica. Dan Gooden wrote this one up. Joe, you and I were talking about this before we got rolling. It's a write-up on a bit of malware called Dazzle Spy, and it's for macOS. Now, normally you see Mac malware, and it's just some crappy installer that relies on the user to actually install it on their own device, and it's all pretty boring, low-grade malware. This one jumped out to me because it actually looks quite good. It looks quite well put together. And apparently it's being used to target pro-democracy types in Hong Kong, which might give you some sort of idea as to who's behind it. But why don't you tell us about this malware, Joe? Because were you as impressed as I was by it?
I was pretty impressed for the reasons that you said, is that typically when we see macOS items, that they involve some degree of user interaction, almost a degree of social engineering to get people to interact with a installer or some other payload in order to allow for subsequent infection steps to take place. Whereas in this case, we had a very effective drive-by installer or drive-by exploit mechanism that required, I think, no interaction, if I recall correctly from Dan's article, that would then allow that device to be compromised, which is a pretty effective and pretty nasty toolkit to not saying that, you know, the adversaries in question here burned a capability on a relatively small target. They probably did something that they thought was very important for whatever they're tasked with, but definitely a very nasty bug, and one that really highlights that pretty much every operating system has something to worry about, and Mac users, as they should have discovered for the last couple of years, can't exactly rely upon, you know, no no viruses, no malware, et cetera, and especially as nastier items like this begin bubbling up within that ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying that for years, right? Which is, Mac obscurity doesn't keep you safe from the top tier crews. But most of the stuff we've caught in the wild previously has just been really dull. And this is the first time I've looked at it and I'm like, wow, okay, whoever put this thing together knew what they were doing.
Yeah, if this was used on a wider scale, it could have definitely captured a number of very interesting targets. And perhaps it has been. We don't really know, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, a very effective item and really goes to show that people are doing their research and identifying some very interesting ways of circumventing the macOS ecosystem.
Now, Ryan Pickren, an independent security researcher, has scored himself a $100,000 bug bounty for what looks to be an absolutely awesome Mac bug.
Yes, this was fun. I mean, it required a little bit of interaction on the part of the user, but really just a pop-up that you would expect if you were interacting with a streaming media or other similar site in order to enable functionality. And just with that minimal level of interaction, then using a chain of bugs between both the webcam and the Safari browser, I believe, allowed for remote code execution and local privilege escalation to essentially complete takeover of the box, which is pretty dang cool to chain those together. So good job on their part in getting that bounty paid out. And again, demonstrating that people are researching this pretty hard and the macOS environment is getting more dangerous as time moves on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sweet bug. So I've got a link in this week's show notes so people can check that out. Cue the Benny Hill music. It is time to talk about crypto, and some finance platform called Qubit apparently has lost $80 million worth of cryptocurrency. This is another one of those, someone found a bug in some Ethereum smart contract that allows cross-chain transactions, which is where a lot of these bugs seem to be popping up. Tom, I believe you wrote you had a good gag in the newsletter, a recent edition where, you know, every edition we do like, you know, three things to make you smile sort of thing. And one of them was there was only $120 million of crypto theft this week, as opposed to $300 million last week. It does feel like this stuff is at just such a regular tempo now that we've become massively desensitized to it. And further to that, there's this trend where now, always when a company gets affected by this sort of thing, they always write to the attacker and offer them a bounty and say, please give us our money back. And sometimes they get it. But geez, this whole scene is just crazy, right?
Yeah, it's ludicrous. I mean, I used to put a story like this in the newsletter because it was new and different, but it seems like it's a month or two later, every damn day, right?
Yeah.
I would be writing about stupid cryptocurrency thefts every week if I did that. You know, if I was to put on my cryptocurrency booster hat, I would say that we're in the phase where people are doing all the dumb stuff and there's a whole lot of dumb people getting on board because they're thinking...
This phase has been going for 10 years.
there's very few bugs that are, like, inherent in the protocol. It's just everyone doing stuff on top. But if I take off my cryptocurrency booster hat, you know, what's the whole point? Like, what's anyone achieving with all of this except funneling money to a whole lot of smart developers?
You're just jealous, Tom. You wish you could invest in crypto and one day you might earn enough money to buy yourself an ape. Wild times on the blockchains, for sure. Now, look, we're going to just whiz through the next couple. There is some Android malware by the looks of things doing the rounds in Brazil, which as part of their MO, the attackers get on the device, ransack it, and then burn it down. Because when the user installs this malware, because it's that sort of malware that they have to sideload from some non-Google Play store, it actually asks for permission to erase all data on the device to have that in its suite of capabilities. And people, of course, click yes. And just worth highlighting, because that's so nasty, the idea is they just brick the device, which slows down the response time of their victim, which is just evil and kind of worth mentioning. And there's a 2FA app in the Google Play store. Apparently has like 10,000 downloads via Google Play that is, of course, laden with malware. So, you know, this is still, Android's still a little bit of a trash fire with a lot of this banking malware now finding its way into the ecosystem. The next one I wanted to talk about with you, Joe, is, and because this is stuff that Joe's in our Slack, it's stuff that we've been talking about over the last month or so in our Slack, which is how the Log4Shell bug would manifest. And it is very much how we predicted. We got a story here from Catalan talking about how Ubiquiti network appliances are being rinsed currently with Log4Shell exploits. So we didn't really see people using Log4Shell to go after enterprise Java. What we did see is people using it to go after vendor kit and then creating a POC that would be distributed widely and then used to do this sort of thing. And yes, here it is in the wild, attacks against Ubiquiti gear.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that was rapidly observed with the Log4Shell, Log4j vulnerability bug, whatever you want to call it, was, you know, certainly innumerable ways of fuzzing it and getting initial exploit conditions, but very wide variability in just what that would do depending upon what the backend application was that was processing that exploit string. And so what we've seen as either actors have matured or people have kind of pulled their heads out of their ears and figured out what's been going on over the last couple of months, because it has been almost a couple of months now, that really using this as a vector for application-specific attacks, whether that's the, I can't remember the VMware product off the top of my head right now.
It was VMware Horizon, yeah, and VMware vCenter, Zyxel Riot routers, and the SolarWinds ServU one was bad because... Yeah. You know, they knew, they would have known Log4j was in there, but they're like, we sanitize user input, so it's fine. But someone found a bypass and then they got rinsed. So, yeah. And apparently there's a POC for Mobile Iron as well. So we are seeing, this is what the long tail of Log4Shell looks like, which is vendors assuming that they're not affected when they are. And that's, you know, come on, do better.
Right. And so we'll see this continue to bubble up, I expect, over the coming year, if not longer, as these items are identified and as workarounds or other, like, we've got this, trust us, become unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah. And look, we're just going to close out the show this week by mentioning a few stories relating to NSO. Like, God, has the worm turned for NSO lately. Finland apparently says it found some Pegasus spyware on some diplomats' phones. So that's a news story via The Record, again, written by Catalin Kimponu. And then we've got a story that was published, I think, by The Washington Post and The Guardian and one other, which is looking at how NSO was offering a US mobile security firm literally bags of cash. This company called Mobilium was offering them bags of cash for SS7 access, which doesn't look really that good. And then there's this massive New York Times Magazine piece all about NSO. It's actually a great read. It's a really good story about NSO, even though it keeps referring to Pegasus as a cyber weapon. Did you two have a chance to read the Times one?
I've skimmed a bit of it. The cyber weapon bit is like nails on the board every time you encounter it, but it looks very promising.
Internet weapon. Internet weapon.
It's got those vibes, right?
Exactly, yeah. But it looks very thoroughly researched, and I'm curious to get my hands on it more thoroughly.
One really interesting thing for me that came out of this story is that in Facebook's lawsuit against NSO, it claimed it saw evidence of at least one US phone number being targeted, right? Like WhatsApp belonging to one US phone number being targeted. It turns out that's probably because the FBI had done like a POC acquisition of Pegasus and was like looking at maybe using it. It looks like it was mostly shelfware, to be honest. The Times has sort of made a lot of hay out of it, but it looks like they bought it and sort of played around with it and never really pulled the trigger. And then, of course, you know, everything for NSO fell apart. But it would explain why one US number showed up as a target, and it was because it was the FBI testing it against a target device, like a test device.
Yeah, I would have thought that the FBI would have different options that they'd be happier with.
Yeah, maybe. But apparently they spent millions of bucks on it and never used it. So, you know, yay for government efficiency. All right, Joe Slowick, Tom Uren, that is actually it for this week's news section. Thank you so much for joining me to fill in for Adam. I really appreciate that. And we'll be chatting again soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for having us.
That was Joe Slowick and Tom Uren there with a check of the week's security news. Big thanks to them for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Anton Chuvakin, the head of security solution strategy at Google Cloud. And today we're talking about a bit of a vendor trend, which is SIEM companies looking at integrating SOAR solutions into their suites of products. The idea being that they're a natural fit. Google has even bought a SOAR company called Seamplify. But yeah, as you'll hear, there's a reason these two technologies haven't really been integrated tightly so far. Basically because they're quite different when you go to implement them, and it's also a hard thing to do. So I started off by asking Anton Chuvakin the simple question, why are SIEM vendors moving in this direction? And here's what he had to say.
Well, that one is easy to answer, and the answer is likely in the very early days of SIEM. We're talking about like early 2000s. A lot of people used SIEM to either aggregate alerts or to do detection, but what do you do with all this stuff? Do you qualify alerts? Do you escalate them? Do you hand them off to somebody else? Do you open an incident? So to me, the fact that SIEM in the early days kind of like ended abruptly at, here's an alert, it's good. And then what? So you give it to somebody and they do it out of an email inbox. So to me, the early SIEMs, including the workflow systems, and they were attempts to make automation work. Like there are some SIEM examples going back 10, 15 years, but ultimately they never committed to the full workflow, full automation, full orchestration, full outbound integration system. So SOAR to me was born out of the desire to A, provide streamlined workflow, consistent workflow, and also automate a lot of steps. Like for example, here's an alert. I need to enrich it. I need to confirm it. I need to hand it off to somebody else. So somebody else is a human step, kind of like an escalation, but a bunch of other steps can be done by a machine. Enrichment, qualification, additional correlation. So to me, SOAR felt almost like a missing piece of SIEM. And so to me, it's more about it coming back to where it belongs.
Yeah.
The only tricky and the only, like I'm making a decent argument, at least you're not arguing with me, but there's one kind of counter argument to this, namely that certain SOAR tasks, certain workflows, certain processes that people automate in SOAR occasionally have nothing to do with SIEM. So for
example, I can understand why you might have a SOAR vendor who would focus on the SOAR stuff and the SIEM stuff, you know, SIEM people on the SIEM stuff, because ultimately, you know, they're pretty, I could see how you would use them in a day at the office together, but ultimately they're pretty different sort of solutions, aren't they? And it would make sense to be, if they were developed by specialists.
Yeah, if they're always connected, though, in sequence, SIEM is to the left of SOAR, SOAR is to the right of SIEM. If they're always trained like carriages in the same train, then it makes sense to like connect them firmly and call them the same carriage. The thing is that there are some SOAR tasks that don't start from a SIEM and don't end in a SIEM, like fission playbooks. All these fun fission playbooks people have written to deal with fission, occasionally they start from an email alert, maybe not from a SIEM, and they finish with some deletion of email or some other stuff. So SIEM may not be involved. So there are some SOAR tasks that don't involve a SIEM, but there are many that do. So to me, the fact that many that do makes SIEM and SOAR friends and possibly even married, as happened with many other vendors.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. But like one issue we've got, and we were talking about this before we started recording, is, you know, if you want to integrate these two things, you're like, no one would accuse modern big time SIEMs of being simple, right? Like they are not simple things. SIEM projects are huge. They're very expensive and often they fail. Often they don't hit, you know, budget and timeline constraints, right? So they're the sort of thing that can blow out and turn into a bit of a nightmare. And I'd imagine it's the same with SOAR, right? So, you know, it's my fear that by gluing these two really complicated big deal projects together, I mean, on the best case, you're sort of, you know, killing two birds with one stone, right? You can integrate these things and everything's wonderful. But I also worry that you could be adding so much complexity by trying to marry these things that you wind up essentially with the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, there is that risk. And of course, my fairly bad joke about XDR that I made on social media a few weeks ago was EDR is hard, SIEM is hard, SOAR is hard. Let's just combine all three and call it XDR. And hey, XDR is simple. Of course, that's not everybody's vision of XDR, but some of the XDR attempts are about picking the simple, usable pieces from each of the three and combining them together. But if you combine all three in one product, EDR, SIEM, and SOAR, you're going to get an ungodly mess, frankly. You need to do other things rather than combine them. So to me, SIEM and SOAR, even if you forget EDR with all the agent complexity, even SIEM and SOAR together have challenges. SOAR has been promising, at least some source promised not having to develop stuff, not having to program, but reality barged in. And in reality, for SOAR success, you do have to occasionally tweak integrations, you have to call APIs. So you kind of have to program a little bit. For SIEM, you don't have to program, but you have to tweak log sources. So there are different buckets of complexity. And if you put them together, you gain some advantages, but you also, you know, you have to deal with both types of complexities. So how are vendors doing it? You know, in various ways. Like if I make a simpler SIEM, like, I don't know, to where put my vendor hat Chronicle, where there's a lot less to manage, I can still find things like dealing with difficult to collect data sources. That's still hard. Dealing with some high volume data sources, that's still hard. But if you add SOAR, now you have to deal with playbooks. You have to deal with outbound integrations where you command or control certain devices. There's work involved, no debate about it.
I mean, one thing that is occurring to me is that, you know, Google SIEM Chronicle is a, you know, it's very much a cloud-based platform too, right? Now, that can make sense when you're doing sort of telemetry collection up into the cloud. That's great. SOAR strikes me that it would have to be, well, it would traditionally have been much more of an on-prem thing as well, right? So, you know, now we're talking about taking these two traditionally on-prem things, seems kind of moving into the cloud. Is SOAR doing the same? And how is that translating as a sort of, you know, cloud-based product?
So that one, I can give you like a really simple answer that's conceptually simple, but operationally is kind of hard. So just as with SIEM, you do retain some presence on premise for collection. If I have to collect Windows logs, if I have to collect, I don't know, mainframe logs, I am keeping an on-prem presence for a SIEM.
But I mean, logs, that's easy, right? Because you can push them around. You push the logs from this thing to that thing that goes to that thing and then up they go. When you're talking about, you know, orchestration and automation, you're talking about having a, you know, some sort of on-prem gateway that has credentials that can touch things and move things. And it sort of just strikes me that it's a more difficult thing to kind of think about as a cloud-based proposition, unlike SIEM.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, not every log is easy to move around, but ultimately you're correct. Most logs you can at least shove around, you can redirect, you can filter. If you have to act, if you have to affect what happens on a database security solution, like your SOAR wants to make a change to a database security solution, the database security tool is deployed somewhere deep inside the network on some database server. So you do need to have a degree of access that's beyond what you need for collecting logs. So yes, that's correct. The presence, the beachhead that SOAR has to keep on premise is larger and it has to do more complex operations. But at the same time, if you do centralize playbooks, if you can centralize some other activities like enrichment in the cloud, you also win. I think you win less, but you win enough by doing SOAR in the cloud, called cloud backended SOAR.
So I guess really ultimately what this is going to look like with a cloud SOAR is most of the smarts up in the cloud. And then, you know, you're going to have a few touch points on your network, aren't you?
Because you will have touch points.
Yeah, quite a few. And they're going to be juicy targets.
That's correct. Just like with vulnerability scanning, if you do credentialed scans, people have been salivating over, well, catching for the credentials in flight, stealing them from a scanner. So yeah, that's a tough task. And that's a task that, frankly, Google with good internal security is very well attired to do, right? Like we protect our secrets, we protect our customers' secrets, we can protect a few more creds. So that part is probably better for us than a startup. Like I don't want to push this button too far, but at the same time, we would probably keep the credentials safer than some others.
So tell me about this SOAR play that Google has acquired.
Yeah, so I don't want to wear my analyst hat and like rank vendors like online on air. But to be honest, we bought a really good SOAR. And we bought a SOAR that works really well in real life. Again, my experience in the past indicates a lot of happy clients for Simplify who deploy the tools for kind of like ever-increasing set of playbooks and ever-increasing tasks within security operations. So to me, this was a good deal. Now, Chronicle has absolutely no outbound integrations like to terminate things, to mitigate, to remediate. We never built any of the SOAR-like stuff. We had some workflow, but we didn't have any of this. So to me, it's kind of a perfect marriage of Chronicle detection and data management expertise with Simplify response and orchestration expertise. We have almost no overlap, which is kind of good. That means we didn't pay for anything we had already.
So what's the plan? I'm guessing that they already would have had some sort of, you know, cloud control layer for this thing, which is what made them attractive to you. And I guess now what, it's a matter of just trying to do as much integration on the back end as possible. I can see how it would work with, as much as you are Google, you know, one of the largest companies in the world, this security part of the organization is relatively new. It's only a few years old. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been greenfields developed. So I'm guessing the integration side is going to be a little bit less traumatic than it would be if you were trying to do it on a legacy SIEM.
I mean, frankly, integrations between two companies that are built from different DNA, different histories are always traumatic. I am sorry. I mean, it's never easy. I don't think, except for possibly some people who left Company X and built something just to be bought by Company X. It's always hard. There's no magic. There's not many shortcuts. But ultimately, customers and ultimately evolution of security operations points us at the fact that a great detection tool, great log analysis tool must have a great orchestration automation layer. Otherwise, no go. Whether it's in the cloud or on-prem, we have to have it. And so integration is also the kind of a word that it may mean different things. Can I call Chronicle APIs from Simplify today? Sure. But you can also call many other products API from Simplify. That's what SOAR does. SOAR calls APIs of other products. That's their bread and butter.
No, so good point.
There's no magic to that. But to me, and again, I don't want to reveal too much of our kitchen, but to me, the magic would happen from things that aren't just SOAR calls SIEM says hi, SIEM sends logs. Sure, that's easy. But there are definitely things you can achieve if you have both products, and you can achieve certain type of automated workflows. You can achieve certain type of assisted workflows. I mean, Google is kind of the home of AI ML. It's like, I always joke about it because like we have probably the most credibility when we talk about AI. And we use it for some capabilities in security, like IAM recommender, we recommend permissions and stuff. So to me, I see a lot of potential for marrying Chronicle, Simplify, and some of our AI ML chops. And not just for traditional tasks like detection, but for things like optimizing workflow, because ultimately the SOC of the future will have machines and humans.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Anton Chivakin, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about the, you know, where SIEM and SOAR can meet, and also about some of your plans over there at Google following your Simplify acquisition. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks again for inviting me.
That was Anton Chivakin there with a chat about SIEM and SOAR and all of that good stuff. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Google Cloud for sponsoring this week's show. And that is it for this week's podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.